little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Well, a very hearty welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, and I'm beaming in remotely via Skype to the KMUD studio in Northern California, as is the other host of this show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Good evening, Bob. It's great to be here, wherever that is today.
We have a great guest, and we're all connected to that guest. Let's start out as we usually do by telling folks how they can get in touch with us, give us feedback about the show, and pop up our previously archived podcast version of Thinking Clearly.
Well, if you like what you hear and you want to make sure that you hear all our episodes of Thinking Clearly, past, present, and future, open up your podcast app and your favorite podcast app, whichever one that might be. Search for a ad feed or new podcast and type Thinking Clearly. We should pop right up. We also love hearing from you, our listening audience. You can contact us at you can find our promos as well as postings of our podcast show when they're ready to be heard.
Here's a little bit of a teaser, a little foreshadowing of the topics for this episode of Thinking Clearly. And it's a quote from the book that we'll be discussing on this episode. And it goes like this, quote, "I envision a discipline that seeks to understand and enhance mental immune function, the things that minds do to shed bad ideas. And I call it cognitive immunology," end quote. So with that in mind, Julia, how would you frame up our topic?
Well, our topic tonight is putting bad ideas and ideology under the microscope of cognitive immunology.
And we'll find out all about that because our guest, Andy Norman, has a PhD in philosophy. He directs the Humanism Initiative at Carnegie Mellon University. And the central themes in his thinking and research that have been motivating his research are reasoning and the role that it plays in overcoming deep mental differences between people. And using metaphor, he's explored the perspective that bad ideas, ideologies, and unfounded conspiracy theories can be thought of as mind parasites, which potentially short-circuit minds and corrupt moral understanding. But he also believes that we can inoculate ourselves, vaccinate our minds against ideological corruption. And the new science of cognitive immunology can lead to a variety of tools that actually help people think together in more fruitful ways. And he's gathered these ideas all together into his recent book called Mental Immunity, Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think. Andy Norman, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you, Julia. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And before we kick it off, Andy, we do want to remind listeners that this live and streaming episode of Thinking Clearly on KMUD, that we're going to be taking calls with questions for our guests about the topics that we've been discussing. That'll take place around 7:45 or so. And okay, we will announce that and give the call-in numbers when we open the phone line. So let's start it off, Andy, by the book title. What do you mean by mental immunity?
Okay, well, thank you. So mental immunity, on my account, is a mind's resistance to infection. So just as our bodies are prone to infection by dangerous microbes, our minds are prone to infection by dangerous ideas. And our minds actually can be said to have immune systems that function either more or less well to protect us against self-replicating packets of information, basically, that can thrive at our expense. So the idea that the QAnon conspiracy is real doesn't do its human hosts any favors, typically alienates them from their family members and their social circles by making people feel isolated. And yet these kooky seeming ideas to many of us manage to infect minds and win the allegiance of many, many human beings. And it's an extraordinary phenomenon that we need to come to grips with. And I think that to understand it, we actually need the language of infection and parasite and immunity to develop countermeasures that can actually protect our minds better. So I think to most ears, the idea that minds have immune systems strikes people as metaphorical. But if you study the history of science, you find that word usage often starts off metaphorical and then morphs into literal usages over time. And a very clear example of this is the word meme. So Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, coined the word meme specifically as an analogy with the concept of a gene. This was back in, I think, 1976. And when he first proposed that we start viewing packets of information that replicate and spread through social networks, when he suggested we call those memes, people were a little reluctant to think of that as literal, and they'd use scare quotes around the word meme. But in the, almost 50 years since, 40 plus years since, respectable scientists have dropped the scare quotes and begun treating memes as entities that can kind of take on a life of their own. And, you know, we can each of us open up our social media feeds and actually see packets of information that have taken on a life of their own. So there's actually a field of study called information epidemiology that Dawkins proposed. And I think that we need to understand not just these bundles of information that can replicate at our expense, but we also need to understand our wherewithal for fending off the worst and the most harmful of them. And we can call the mind's infrastructure for spotting and shedding bad ideas, we can call that a mental immune system. And if we define the term mental immune system in that way, it becomes straightforwardly, literally true that our minds have such infrastructure and therefore have mental immune systems. But let me suggest kind of a fun way for your audience to kind of get their heads around this idea and try to make it real. And I'm going to try to enlist, say, Julia in a thought experiment here. Julia, are you game?
I am. I give consent.
Okay. So, Julia, I want you to imagine, think of something you're either really proud of or something that's really precious to you, maybe an accomplishment or a cherished value of some kind.
I'm thinking really hard. Okay. All right. Okay.
Is that something you're willing to share?
I don't mean to be selfish, but I want to say this radio show is an accomplishment I'm very proud of.
All right. Beautiful example. And that'll work nicely for our purposes. Now, I want you to imagine, Julia, that you go online someday and some internet troll has just been trashing your work on this radio show.
Not hard to imagine.
Maybe you've come across this before. In that case, so tell me what goes through your mind when you see something like that?
I think my initial reaction is I'm frustrated. Mm-hmm. And I assume that the other person is perhaps misguided.
Mm-hmm. So it's very easy to start questioning this person's, whether this person is well-informed, whether this person is fair-minded, right? Whether this person is it in his right mind. Right? These are the kind of questions that just pop into the mind. So I think we've all had experiences like this. What you're witnessing there and what we've just heard Julia describe as something that goes on sometimes perhaps in her mind, what you're witnessing there is the mind's immune system in action. The questions and the challenges and the reservations and the criticisms that rush into your mind that basically swarm to the scene of this injurious troll attack, those are actually your mind's antibodies at work. And they're trying to protect your mind against information that feels threatening. And in fact, they're trying to neutralize that information in various ways, because if you can diminish the judgment or the logic or the reliability of the internet troll, that serves to protect the thing that you find precious, something that you write. The experiment we've just done perfectly parallels a famous experiment from the history of science where a Russian zoologist took a starfish and he stabbed it with a tangerine thorn and he stuck it under a microscope. And he was the first human being ever to witness the body's immune system in action. He watched as white blood cells swarmed to the scene of the injury in the starfish and tried to neutralize the tip of the thorn. He wrote up his results. He later won a Nobel Prize for it. And we began to understand the mechanisms that allow the body's immune system to work. We can do the exact same thing to understand how our minds deal with not just threatening information, but also with bad information or harmful information. And it turns out that mental immune systems sometimes get their wires crossed and actually attack good information.
Yeah, that makes sense. It really explains why trolls often make me feel like I want to throw my computer out the window.
Right. I remember, I grew up in a family that practically worshipped Martin Luther King. And some decades later, as a young adult, I actually heard that Martin Luther King had been a serial philanderer who was not faithful to his wife. And when I heard this information, it just completely challenged, it threatened something that I wanted to view as pure, Martin Luther King's moral character. And so I refused to believe it. And questions and doubts swarmed into my mind in an attempt to neutralize this threatening information. Now, it turns out it was true information. It was good information. But my first thought was, oh, that must be something that J. Edgar Hoover was spreading in order to assassinate King's character. That was my mind's immune system actually misfiring and refusing to let me believe something that was true.
Being an observer in this, I think that was really a powerful way to sort of broach the subject and make it real for us. And as I'm thinking about this, it seems also that the immune system, kind of extending the metaphor to some extent, that the immune system is actually trying to bring us back to homeostasis. And I could extend that in thinking about cognitive dissonance. Mm. So example you gave could be related to a subject that's been much studied in psychology, cognitive dissonance. So what I want to say about this, and I think then Julia has a question for you, but what I want to say about this is that the thing I like, and I do believe that at this point, what you're doing is metaphorically mapping, but I also get the sense that, yes, if we take this metaphor and work with it and begin to use it as a cohesive idea to bring together all the disparate research that's being done in economics, social, the social sciences, psychology, cognitive science, anthropology, all these different fields that are studying a lot of the same phenomena. And it may be a way to help make this whole thing more interdisciplinary and kind of rally around that metaphor.
Yeah, I think it has that potential to kind of be a unifying paradigm. I know your theme here on this show is critical thinking. I've come to the view that this cognitive immunology is my word for the science of mental immunity. I've actually come to think of the cognitive immunology paradigm as something that's going to supersede the critical thinking paradigm, or perhaps not supersede it so much as take it to a whole nother level. It turns out there's a whole lot more to healthy mental immune function than was ever dreamt of in the critical thinking textbooks that I used to teach from as a young professor.
Yeah, I also love the idea that philosophers could be cognitive epidemiologists, you know, really, I think, you know, maybe makes it a little sexier. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we philosophers have been craving scientific legitimacy for about 2.5 millennia. And it turns out that epistemology, the particular specialty within philosophy that I ended up doing research in, epistemology is the study of how we think and reason and know things. And it turns out that a lot of epistemology, a lot of findings in epistemology translate over into the language of immunology in kind of fun ways that help us, that can help us learn to think more clearly and more effectively.
Oh, how interesting. And we're all becoming much more versed in the language of immunology. So it seems like a good time. In your book, Mental Immunity, you tell a story about your experience of first teaching philosophy as a university professor when you made a transition from, you know, boring lecturer to student learning facilitator of collaborative reason-giving dialogue, or as you call the approach, collaborative inquiry. Can you take us back to that evolution?
Sure. So when you go to grad school to study epistemology, you end up becoming hyper-specialized and you speak some specialized jargon-ridden language that very few people in the world grok or understand. And then without really teaching you how to teach, they just kind of say, okay, here's your professorship, go to work. And I found myself in a classroom and I was incredibly insecure because I just didn't feel like I belonged there. It was almost felt like imposter syndrome, right? I know I've been packing my head full of all these technical arcane things, but I didn't really know how to connect with my students. And so a semester's attempt at teaching kind of failed miserably, and I was kind of at the end of my rope. And instead of walking into the classroom and pretending that I needed to dispense wisdom that I'd already acquired, I changed my approach. And I basically just went in and threw out questions that I had no idea how to answer myself. And I asked my students, what do you guys think? And I kind of just used questions to help to get them to educate me. And I tell you, they went from being bored to just loving the kind of discussions we had in that classroom. And it was all because I'd climbed off my expert pedestal and just welcomed them into sort of a collaborative attempt to make sense of things. For any other teachers out there who are sort of struggling with a less than enthusiastic set of students, I highly encourage you to take a similar approach. I don't think you don't have to be a philosopher to do this. You just need to take some time in your preparation to identify the questions that really animate people and introduce those questions in a way that gets catch students' interest. And then you just kind of turn them loose, listen to what they have to say, help them articulate their points better, have them respond to each other's points, and just see where it goes. If you start off thinking you have all the answers, conversation is kind of dull. But if you actually engage in conversation, trying to find out together what's true, conversation is a whole nother level of fun. And if you practice it just a little, you can start deriving the benefits in no time.
And you talk extensively in your book about the basis of the Socratic method and the Platonic method. And that's a marvelous chapter that I really enjoyed in the book. I heartily recommend folks get the book just for that chapter alone. This is a related question, because in your book, Mental Immunity, you write about how back in the 1990s, about the same time that Julia just took you back to, you read an essay and you did mention the evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins, and he wrote a essay, I guess it was, Virtues of the Mind, and the idea there was that the mind could get infected by thoughts. And you took that concept, ran with it, and wound up changing the way that you that you taught your critical thinking courses. You mentioned that critical thinking used to be much more limited than you're thinking about it now. Tell us that story, because it seems to be an origin story for the birth of the book.
Yeah, actually, that's a really lovely question. Thank you, Bob. As a young professor, the journal Ethics came to me and asked me to review a book. And in that book, there was an essay by Dawkins called Viruses of the Mind, in which he actually compares religious beliefs to mind viruses. Now, that was, I didn't want to get into all of the difficult politics of that claim about religion. But one of the things Dawkins did in that essay was he compared a gullible six-year-old who was the daughter of a friend, a gullible six-year-old who, if you told her the tooth fairy exists, she would believe you. And he compared this six-year-old to an immune-compromised adult. He basically said, this little girl's mind doesn't have resistance to fairy tales in the same way that a well-adjusted adult mind does. That analogy struck me, and it occurred to me that Dawkins's call for information epidemiology, the study of how ideas can spread kind of in a viral fashion, needed to be combined with a discipline that studies how minds become more or less susceptible to ideas that may be false or harmful or otherwise problematic. And so it took me a long time to gain sufficient clarity about this, but over time it emerged. It took the form of this framework that I call cognitive immunology. But when I was first working with the ideas, I took them into a classroom where I was teaching critical thinking, and I, instead of discussing the assigned reading, I kicked off one class by just saying, hey guys, what do you guys think a mind can become infected? And the students were like, well, you mean a brain? And I was like, no, I mean a mind. And so one of the students says, well, infected with what? And I said, bad ideas. And I said, well, tell you what, why don't you guys get together and think it through? And this was really before the internet had become a big thing. And so the students talked about it for about 10 minutes, and they said, yeah, it kind of makes sense to us. Mind infections does make sense. Mind viruses do exist, and maybe we should take such talk seriously. Now, students today, it would take them all of like 10 seconds to decide that question, because they just see mind infections spread across the internet every day. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, how do you think this talk of mind infection relates to what we're doing here in this critical thinking class? And one of them says, is this critical thinking supposed to protect us against mind viruses? And I said, yeah, that's the idea. He said, so like critical thinking is the mind's immune system? I was like, yeah, that's you got it. That's what we're trying to do in this class, just build your immunity to false, misleading, problematic, disastrous, violence-inducing, and other problematic ideas. And they were like, cool, let's figure out how to do this. So I actually had them actually study the body's immune system. And they said, well, they came back to me and said, well, the body has these antibodies that basically fight off disease. And I'm like, well, what would be the corresponding thing in the mind? And they talked about it, and they thought about it, and they did their research, and they came back to me a few days later, and they said, well, we think questions and reasons are like the mind's antibodies. And I was like, way to go, guys. Let's figure out how we can use questions and reasons to do battle with bad ideas. And we invented a little game that I call the reason-giving game. And instead of me lecturing, we actually played this game where we tested each other's ideas in a friendly, collaborative way. And the students just ate it up. I think it was a better way to teach critical thinking, and I hope all critical thinking takes something like that form in 5 or 10 years from now.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be 5 or 10 years. But, you know, the other thing I was thinking about in terms of cognitive immunology is besides unifying some of the people doing research, it could be a unifying, and this is, I think, what you just said, it can be a unifying theme around people who want to be what I call information activists, which are they're folks that want to use critical thinking to make our information environments better. So it could be sort of a way that, just like your students rallied to the metaphors and the theme that you're talking about, folks on this show could do that. Anyone who is involved in any of the many, many different organizations now that are around to try to improve the information ecosystem could rally to that. And the other thing is that the metaphor also gives us the idea that we're not out to get rid of the bad people. The target is the bad ideas.
Yes.
And that takes a lot of the sting and defensiveness and bad interactions that take place.
That's such an important distinction, Bob. Whenever you test ideas with somebody else, you have to remember that your ideas aren't you. Because when other people criticize those ideas, that doesn't mean that you're any less of a person. But if you cling tightly to ideas, make them part of your identity, you'll instantly get defensive when questions are raised about those ideas. So it's really, generally speaking, it's a bad idea to identify with your beliefs. If you want to keep an open mind that can learn without getting, without seizing up and getting really anxious when you're trying to test ideas and learn, you should treat ideas as like temporary house guests that may be welcome in your mind for now, but somewhere down the road, they might wear out their welcome and it's best to show them the door.
Another good metaphor.
Yeah, I think it's very easy to slip into a mindset where your ideas are like precious heirloom furniture that you have to cling on to, and the people who would challenge them are like the unwelcome house guests. And I actually think we ought to flip that on the head. Think of your beliefs as the house guests and our fellow human beings as you know precious co-residents of this planet that we need to respect and honor and get along with.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. On the show, we've talked about cognitive self-defense. And I think that what you're really hitting on is that sometimes that self-defense also includes cleaning one's own home, right?
Oh, that's actually a really nice point, Julia. It reminds me of a TED Talk I saw once that said, a big part of creating an information space where we can actually have constructive conversations is to learn to be less defensive. We all tend to worry that the other people are at fault for aggravating or irritating us, but we can actually learn to be less irritable, less easily aggravated. And that's a big part of the equation. We need to calm our own mental immune system so that we can engage in fruitful dialogue and not let them be triggered by, hot button concepts or topics.
Absolutely. Yeah. What are some of the other key ideas in your book that are foundational for understanding your perspective on reasoning and belief formation? For example, the idea of reason's fulcrum seems pivotal, if you will. See what I did there?
Yeah, very good. Yeah. So if you ask me, what's the number one thing we can do to promote a more civil, well-functioning society, I would say build up and reinforce the norm that requires everybody to yield to better reasons. So here's the picture. Reasons are kind of like levers. The informational content of the reason pushes down on one end of the lever, and the other end of the lever is supposed to nudge a belief or change your mind in some way, maybe by installing a belief or removing one or changing your confidence level. But here's the thing. Unless you accept your responsibility to yield to better reasons have zero power to educate and enlighten you. And if you make a habit of just defying better reasons, the way our former president did, for example, you actually end up damaging your own mind's immune system. The economist John Maynard Keynes had a famous quote. He said, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? And I mean, this is one of the smartest guys who ever lived. And he lived by the credo, every time I encounter new information, I'm going to update my belief system. I'm going to update my thinking so that my mental models of the world can continually get more and more accurate and more nuanced. And he did that and went on to win Nobel Prizes and stuff in economics. Don't quote me on that. I may be misremembering on whether he won a Nobel Prize. But if you actually study the way reasoning works, what you end up seeing is that when one or both parties to a conversation try to persuade without making themselves persuadable, they turn something that could be enlightening and that could bring the parties together into a futile exercise of trying to change one another. Genuine dialogue, genuine learning, genuine science, genuine inquiry, genuine procedural justice, all of these things require that we yield to better reasons. When we honor and reinforce that norm, societies grow together in positive ways. When we flout that norm, when we defy it, societies begin to break down into factions, partisanship skyrockets, and those societies start tearing each other apart. So the number one thing we can do to fix our crazy post-truth predicament is to uphold the norms of accountable talk and abide by those norms ourselves, not just insist that other people abide by them.
I like it when the rules apply to other people and not me.
Well, don't we all?
In your book, under the heading of What You Can Do, you give what you call a kind of 12-step program to cognitive immune health. Describe a few of the most important of these suggestions and how our listeners could best start experimenting with what you are advocating for.
So I've mentioned one or two already. Let me start with this one. The first thing one should do is avoid believing things simply because you want them to be true. Reserve belief for things that you know to be true. Now, I don't know for a objective fact that human beings have rights. So to honor that idea, what I do is I accept it as a useful way to promote well-being among human beings. But I try not to think about, but my attitude towards the idea that humans have rights is not quite belief, because I don't have factual evidence that we are, say, endowed by our creator with inalienable rights. I try to uphold the functional utility of the idea that we have rights, but I try not to. But it's, so we all, that's maybe not the best example to illustrate how damaging willful belief can be. But if you indulge your taste for willful belief in some areas of your life, the research now says that you will be less able to prevent yourself from succumbing to willful belief in other areas of your life. So, for example, if you indulge in belief that, you know, that you will live for all eternity at alongside the Lord, and you believe that because you want to believe it, then when a conspiracy theory like QAnon comes along, you'll be more susceptible to that conspiracy theory than somebody who didn't allow themselves to believe something just because they wanted it to be true. So an important discipline to develop is to try to avoid willful believing. It corrupts mental immune systems. I've mentioned testing your ideas. So engage in the kind of conversation where you and a bunch of friends gently test each other's ideas with questions. The Scottish philosopher David Hume said, "Truth springs from arguments between friends." And Bob mentioned the Socratic method before. I think the Socratic method, where you use questions to probe the first to clarify other views, both your own and others, and then to sort of probe them for weaknesses. That's one of the most brilliant mind inoculation techniques ever invented. I argue that it's a mind inoculant that deserves a great deal of respect. And in the later chapters of my book, I take the Socratic method and refine it in the same way that an immunologist might refine an inoculant into a vaccine. And I argue that what I call the new Socratic method, or a refined version of the Socratic method, can go even further in the direction of giving us next level mental immunity.
I was just wondering whether you've given a couple, or another one, or
I'll toss in one or two more.
Yeah.
So always reason to find out, never reason to win. The current culture war features two political parties that try to use reasons to bash each other and to win public approval, win votes, win power. But when you start using reasons as weapons, instead of using reasons as pointers to draw a collaborator's attention to relevant considerations, you're compromising your own mind's immune system, because the martial use of your mind's antibodies will come back and begin to fill your mind with delusions. So always reason to find out. Here's a particularly powerful one, I think. Most of us imagine that most of us have the following picture of what a reasonable idea looks like. A reasonable idea is one that is supported by good reasons. I call that the Platonic model, or the Platonic picture of reasonable belief. But it turns out that if you analyze that view carefully, it's philosophically problematic. And a better picture of reasonable belief is the one Socrates championed, namely that a genuinely reasonable belief is one that can withstand questioning. So instead of viewing a reasonable idea as one that sits atop an edifice of reasons, think of a reasonable belief as one that can fend off challenges, objections, and questions and remain credible. And if you can make that mental substitution, you'll start looking for the right things and stop overlooking some of the important considerations, and you'll start to become a wiser version of yourself.
Very good. Now, we like to leave our listeners with some sort of things that they can practice on, resources to practice their critical thinking and their communicative skills and their dialogue with other folks to make them more productive. So those are some good ideas, starting out with the idea of trying to engage someone in collaborative inquiry, trying to ask some good questions, being aware that if you're really holding on to a belief, to step back a little bit and argue vehemently for those things that you know and can provide a great deal of evidence and support for, and be a little more tentative about those ideas that are not as solid and need some development. We're going to open the phone lines in 4 or 5 minutes, and I'll give the phone numbers then, but I want to point us to this, that in the conclusion of your book, you express some real high hopes for cognitive immunology.
Yeah.
And I'm going to read a fairly long quote to show your optimism here. It goes like this. "As the principles of cognitive immunology spread, we'll become more aware of cognitive immune disorders and begin to see overlooked remedies. We'll devise cognitive inoculants and take a more systematic approach to achieving mental immune health. Universities will launch cognitive immunology departments, and researchers will share their findings in new journals, end quote. So by writing this book, Andy, you realize that you've birthed the baby, but where do you go from here to foster its development?
Oh, wow. I guess I want to say two things about that. If you're not quite sure whether it makes sense to share my optimism for this discipline, think about how radically the science of biological immunity changed the human condition. So prior to the germ theory of disease and the field of immunology being a thing, human beings were at the mercy of dangerous microbes that just inflicted pain and fear and suffering and death among human beings on a scale we can barely imagine these days. Well, perhaps we can't imagine it with COVID running around, but that was a regular occurrence prior to the science of immunology. I think that when we grow the science of cognitive immunology and begin to apply its principles, the outbreaks of unreason and conspiracy thinking and science denial that currently plague our world are going to begin to go away, or at least be seriously curtailed. So we can look forward to a world, I think, that is dramatically less susceptible to dangerous ideologies. To help bring about this world, I'm founding a nonprofit called CIRCE, which is the Cognitive Immunology Research Center. Your listeners can find it at cognitiveimmunology.net on the internet. But I'll be working with researchers and practitioners, people who want to apply these ideas to improve critical thinking and enhance civil discourse in the years to come. And it sounds like you, Bob, and you, Julia, are fellow travelers in that regard, and I'd welcome your collaboration.
Yeah, put us on the list. And because, Andy, I was a little afraid that after the enormous task of writing a book like this, that you would just want to go to some beach and sell burritos with your wife.
Bob is referring to a remark I left in my acknowledgments. My wife has endured my obsessive passion for this project for a very long time, and she's dreamt of opening a burrito shack on the beach. And at some point in my career, I'm going to have to repay her kindness and tolerance by letting her do that. But I do want to continue to fight the good fight too.
Good, good. I've got a couple ideas too. A workbook to accompany this book. I think that these ideas, that especially in your 12-step approach there, that some of them are a little general, and to actually put those ideas into practice, I think a workbook to accompany the book that goes through step-by-step skills building would be one idea. Another idea would be, because you've worked with what you call the reason-giving game, but yes. I looked for maybe a demonstration of that, and couldn't really find it. I think that would be a great thing to do, a demonstration with two practitioners that know that well, and put it on YouTube. And eventually hope with this organization that you're forming and trying to gain support from researchers and that sort of thing, that there will be a conference in the future.
I love the suggestions, Bob. These are wonderful. I'm taking notes.
And, see that.
these could well be follow-up projects that happen.
Okay, well,
my suggestion is your book should come with a burrito.
People would buy it for the burrito, and then
okay. I mean, it seems like a good way to spread the idea.
Yeah. and do what he was going to do in the first place, you know, sell those burritos. As we're waiting for some calls, maybe someone will fact check that Nobel Prize statement that you weren't quite
John
sure.
John Maynard Keynes, yeah. Did he win?
Yeah. One of the things that I thought about, because you talk a lot about the problem of people who are dogmatic about their beliefs, and I would describe it as not being susceptible to collaborative inquiry. So they're dogmatic of their beliefs. But what about actually those people who weaponize information? Meaning those who purposely use disinformation to anger, confuse, and manipulate other people.
I'm going to interrupt that amazing question there.
We'll hold it in abeyance.
Okay, coming back to that.
Because we have some eager callers. We have two callers. So Engineer Dan, why don't we take our first caller? Hello, caller.
Hi.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Continue the metaphor about like the vaccine hesitance, right? If we're going to talk about the brain immunology. Mm-hmm. And so my question is around influence. So I heard you talk about belief versus knowledge and Socratic method of asking questions. And I love the always reason to find out and not to win. Mm. So when you're engaging in conversation with people, that idea that, asking questions and how a good, belief is one that can withstand good questions.
Yes.
Often you get the gotcha straw man response.
Yes.
So how do you suggest is the best way? I love what you said for my own kind of understanding to like check myself, but what do you suggest is the best way to guide other people to practice this brain or cognitive immunology?
That's a wonderful question, and thank you for it. The people you have conversations with can vary enormously in their receptivity, I guess, to some of these ideas. So one of my colleagues in the cognitive immunology field has come up with an app called Crazy Uncle. Cranky Uncle. Cranky Uncle. And the Cranky Uncle will holds all these conspiracy theories, and you try to figure out what to say to your cranky uncle, and you tap your phone, you choose multiple choice. And it turns out that if you ridicule cranky uncle, he just digs his heels in and gets more stubborn. But if you ask clarifying questions and gently call attention, you have to use questions in a somewhat artful way to help people see what they're saying and to understand what they're saying in a new way. A lot of times people will spout nonsense and not even see that it's nonsense. And the role of a interlocutor in a situation like that is to, number one, just be a good supportive listener, ask clarifying questions, and just draw them out to the point where they can actually start to see the weaknesses in the views they've articulated. There's even a technique called motivational interviewing, where you basically just try to understand the deep motives behind people's conspiracy thinking or, stubborn ideologies. Understand the underlying motivations, drill down to a point where you can recognize the motivation as admirable, validate that, and then gently help them reframe the ideas to better serve the same ends that you share.
Sort of a jiu-jitsu approach. You take their energy and guide it in a good direction. That was the cranky uncle is John Cook, and we had him as a guest on Thinking Clearly. So that's
I want to. I want to give a good shout out to John Cook and the Cranky Uncle app. You can look it up in your app store, either for iPhone or for Android. And I've definitely enjoyed it on a few occasions in a waiting room or something like that. Yeah.
And I should add that John Cook has done some really interesting experiments on mind inoculation. He's actually tried to measure the effectiveness of mind inoculation techniques. And so he's really doing good work.
Yeah, there's so much good work being done. So I want to... thank the caller. That's a very good question. Let's go to the next caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Yes, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
I would like to discuss this very point, how to tell the truth. When we want to prove a point, we may be tempted to twist the truth or say something that is only partially true. Mm. We may exaggerate intentionally by making something to be greater or more extreme than it is. We may add, embellish, or invent details to prove we are right. Mm. This kind of speech can lead to misunderstanding and distrust. Mm. We have to practice speaking the truth and speaking it skillfully. If we're not skillful, we may say something that we think is truthful, but it might still make others suffer or despair.
Yes.
Just because we have observed or experienced something doesn't mean we should speak about it as if doing so will make others suffer.
Hmm. Wow. There's a lot to think about there. Yeah, thank you for that.
And I do think we have one more caller as well. We're down to our last 3 minutes. So
give the last caller a couple words of wisdom, and then we'll take that last call.
Yeah. Boy, where to begin? Yeah, I think the real wisdom that I heard in that is to resist your own temptation to first of all, exempt your own ideas from the kind of standards you would hold other people's views to. So when you allow yourself, when you let yourself exaggerate and draw on falsehoods to look smarter or to validate your point of view, you're not showing the kind of integrity you would like to have your conversation partner to hold. So hold yourself to the same standards you would have others observe.
The golden rule of cognitive immunology.
That's right.
And critical thinking. Let's take the last caller. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Hi, Bob. This is Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast, and I'm really enjoying the show.
Hi, Jeff.
Tonight, and appreciate both of you as co-hosts on this program. It's really been interesting what I've been able to hear. The cognitive immunity is a fascinating concept. Please, on your outro, give the name of your guest and the name of the book, because I did tune in a bit late, but the gotcha between the GOP and the Dems, how do we curb that so that it's not a game of gotcha, it's not who won, which seems to be what's going on right now, and bring it back to what you had mentioned earlier on having arguments for a purpose with a result that benefits all rather than like two teams in one league in this over and over gotcha game they seem to be playing. I hope there's something in there. Thank you, Julia.
Good question from Jeff on the Mendocino Coast. Andy Norman, you've got just about a minute to answer that question.
Oh, a wonderful question, Jeff. Yeah, I mean, you can approach conversation as a zero-sum game or as something that requires that the other person lose so that you can win. And if you do that, you're shooting yourself in the foot cognitively. It's much, much, much more constructive to treat conversation partners as collaborators who together want to arrive at a deeper, richer, more nuanced sense of the truth than either one of you could have arrived at alone. You have to approach dialogue in that spirit, or number one, you're going to create enemies. But number two, your own mind will begin to betray you.
Great point. We often fall to debate, and here we're kind of emphasizing the collaboration. Excellent point.
Thank you very much, Andy. Andy Norman, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your experience, your wisdom with us, and insights, and information from your book. The whole title being Mental Immunity. What's the rest of that title?
Infectious Ideas, Mind Parasites, and the Search for a Better Way to Think.
And we've just scratched the surface of the book, Deep Thinking in that book. And I really love the philosophical seasoning that you added throughout the book. It's a book that will make readers temporarily set the book aside, like I did at many moments, to think deeply about those issues that you're discussing. And I couldn't find a single section of that book to skim read. I used up a whole highlighter, Julia.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, I'm going to have to buy you a 12-pack, Bob. Cognitiveimmunology.net also looks like it has a host of great resources I'm looking forward to diving into as well.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. So we'll put that on our Facebook page, too, along with a link to your book and to your personal site at andynorman.org. Are there any other links you'd like us to include, Andy?
That's fine. Thank you. You've been very generous.
So thanks again, and thanks to our engineer, Dan Murphy, and a big thanks to our listeners. Very good questions. And as always, thank you, Julia. Until next time, keep thinking clearly.